Zoos. Love them or loathe them, there's one in almost every big city. Although for many visitors they're just another tourist attraction, modern zoos see themselves as valuable places of education, scientific research and, especially these days, conservation. I'm Keri Phillips and today, come with me on a trip to the zoo.
A zoo worker's been attacked by a tiger on Queensland's Sunshine Coast.
The animals at the Werribee Open Range Zoo near Melbourne are in for a Christmas treat. Meerkats, lions and monkeys will be among those receiving special festive presents, ranging from scented oils to rhino poo from the zookeepers.
The plan is for night tours when visitors sipping champagne will be titillated by tales of the gay sex life of animals and possibly even witness it for themselves.
People have collected and kept animals, often to symbolise power, for thousands of years. During the 18th and 19th centuries, what were known as menageries, often royal collections, were turned into zoos and ultimately made open to the public. Although such zoos had already been established in Vienna, Paris and Madrid, the London Zoo, established in 1826, marked the first step in the evolution of the modern zoo. Dr. Nigel Rothfels from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is the author of several books, including Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo.
The thing about it is that it was intended as a place for the fellows of the Zoological Society to have a study collection, essentially. It was not what you might imagine as a big open public space, but it was a very private space for the fellows themselves. What tended to happen, though, is in fairly short order, so in other words, within the first 7-8 years, they began to realize that the fellows were writing so many permissions for their friends and acquaintances to visit the collection that they began to open it up to visiting days for a broader public. So, you know, by the mid-1830s, the zoo is becoming very much a public space in Regent's Park.
What kind of animals were held in the zoo at that point?
Well, it was a very small space with a bear pit right off the bat. You have to imagine it's basically a square hole in the ground with a tree sunk or a large climbing object in the middle of it for the bears to climb up. And there was a little concession stand at the very end, and there's so many images from the 19th century of someone at the concession stand holding on a long pole, holding a bun out to the bears to grab. This is, you know, in many ways one of the iconic images of the London Zoo in the 19th century. The interesting thing about it is that obviously very little that's scientific about that thing, and it points very quickly to the increasing focus of that facility in the 19th century as a place for recreation and pleasure. By the 1840s, there's a carnivora terrace, which is essentially a series of picture frame cages for the lions and whatnot. There's large gardens and lawns for people to picnic upon. And there's monkey cages, lots of bird collections, but it was not a very, very large collection.
Many of its cages were barred and quite small and fairly sterile. They didn't have lots of vegetation in them.
Dr. Michael Hutchins is currently the director of the BirdSmart Wind Energy Campaign for the American Bird Conservancy. He's been involved in zoos and conservation for over 40 years.
One of the major concerns of zoos at that time is that they couldn't keep animals alive very long. They didn't know very much about their biology, about their diets, about the group compositions that they should be kept in or about their reproduction. They knew very little about them. But one of the major concerns, of course, was disease. So these smaller sterile cages were easy to clean out and a little easier to keep sterile so that animals wouldn't die readily from disease.
At the end of the 19th century, Carl Hagenbeck, perhaps one of the most unusual figures in the history of the modern zoo, had an idea that would revolutionize the way animals were displayed.
Carl Hagenbeck was born in 1844. By the 1860s, so when he's just a late teenager, he has started a small animal business in Hamburg in Germany. By the 1880s, so about 20 years later, he is the international figure in the international trade in animals. So if you have an unusual animal request that you want to have, for example, a thylacine, a Tasmanian wolf in New York City, you call Carl Hagenbeck, who arranges for it to be shipped from down under by you guys. But if you're also a European and you want an American crocodile, then you get that from him. So he is this figure who manages to build up a very large animal business of acquiring the most unusual animals in the world and providing them to zoos. At the same time, beginning in the 1870s, he starts to exhibit exotic people in Europe. These are exhibitions of cultures. And along with the animals, essentially, along with these shipments of animals would come then a group of people, a group of indigenous people from Australia, a group of indigenous people from North America, and they would be exhibited in what became his small zoo, which was actually his place of business. But then they would also travel to the major zoological gardens of Europe. And then in 1907, he opened a zoo of his own, and it's called Hagenbeck's Tierpark, Hagenbeck's Animal Park. It's in a suburb of Hamburg. And this zoo is noted for being the first zoo to really deploy barless exhibits.
It took a circus operator and a sculptor, as it happens, to create Hagenbeck's Zoo in Hamburg, which set out to display animals as you would expect to see them in the wild.
Michael Great spent 20 years at Singapore Zoo as an architect and exhibit designer before becoming an independent consultant. We spoke by Skype.
And it actually embodies many of the principles that zoos use to this day. Open enclosures without barred cages. In fact, a primary motive was so that the animals themselves do not feel imprisoned, even though it's a bit debatable whether the animal cares whether it's confined by bars or confined by a moat. It's someone who basically came from left field. He was not a scientist. He was an entrepreneur, zoo operator and animal dealer. He decided to set up his own zoo, and he engaged a sculptor to actually carve artificial rock out of concrete and created the first landscapes of that type, which were quite realistic and became much imitated, even though they were scorned at the beginning because they didn't the method of display or the arrangement of the animals ceased to be taxonomic, so they were displayed in more or less ecological groups with layered views. So you would have predators displayed at the back of prey animals in that kind of tableau.
Hagenbeck's ideas would become increasingly influential and lead to a reinvention of zoo design in the second half of the 20th century. During the 1970s, Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle opened what is generally considered the first immersion exhibit under the direction of the architect David Hancocks. Michael Hutchins worked at Woodland Park in the 1970s and 80s.
What was happening at that time was there was a great interest in the ethology and social biology of animals, and there were lots of field studies being done about animals and their ecology and behavior. And the idea was to use that knowledge to design new exhibits that were much more appropriate for the animals and allowed them to express a larger percentage of their behavior as they would in the wild. So there was much more extensive vegetation. The exhibits started to become larger, more complex. There were other things that were happening. You started to see the development in the 1990s, of something called environmental enrichment. So there was some of that going on there too, where the animals were being fed in ways that also precipitated natural behaviors, like, for instance, primates were fed by spreading seeds in the grass, and they would pick through them just as they would in nature. And it gave them something to do, so there wasn't the sterility and boredom of previous older exhibits. And also the enclosure sizes allowed for larger, more naturalistic social groups for animals that lived in social situations. So all of these things started to come together at that time, and Woodland Park was one of the first zoos to begin to incorporate all of those ideas into their exhibit design philosophy.
It became noted for something called the immersion exhibit. So if you imagine, in a sense, that the Hagenbeck step in this evolution had to do with people standing on one side of a moat and looking into an exhibit and finding animals who were apparently living in the wild, the immersion exhibit was sort of a next step in this, where you would try to figure out ways where you could put people also into that setting itself, so that the people are actually somehow immersed in the exhibit. Key elements of this had to do with trying to bring down the amount of other people that you saw, so that they would invent the winding paths to make sure that in any given view you were less likely to see other people, but that you would try to develop ways where the exhibit somehow came out into the space that the visitors were themselves. And that's, I think, the sort of key element of the Woodland Park. And it became something which is, you know, has become phenomenally successful. And with new kinds of technology, especially some of the ideas around aquariums and different kinds of things, people can go to zoos now that are at the top end of things, where that is really deployed at a very effective level. Whether people learn more again, or whether the science is somehow more profound, or whether the conservation efforts, which became in the 20th century sort of the fourth pillar following science education and recreation, the fourth pillar conservation enters. And once that happens, there's a new raison d'etre for zoos. But whether immersion exhibits somehow contribute to conservation or somehow contribute to science has been a problematic conclusion to reach. Certainly, they're more entertaining.
You're listening to Rear Vision with Kerry Phillips. Today, we're hearing about the evolution of the modern zoo.
You know, historians often look at these different phases of the development or the evolution of the modern zoo and sort of these revolutions in exhibit design.
Professor Ben Mintier is an environmental ethicist and conservation scholar at Arizona State University. I spoke to him by Skype.
I think also parallel revolutions in ideas about our relationship to animals and to animals in zoos and collections. And there's definitely a shift, I think, a post-war shift, and then a late 20th century shift, where the concern for naturalism in zoo exhibits was sucked up into this larger concern for ecology and conservation, where the concern for improvements in animal welfare and the well-being of animals in captivity, or managed care, as the zoo community likes to call it, where that was also increasingly on the agenda of the zoo community, and certainly part of a growing public ethic regarding zoo animals and wildlife and conservation more generally. I think that Hancock's and others in the zoo world during this time were conversant in these kinds of developments and were really eager, you know, keen to see zoos move into this new territory, which in a sense you could say is a step closer toward a wildlife park, or closer toward a, you know, a natural area of some sort.
Was there any external pressure on zoos to improve animal welfare and the circumstances for animals in captivity?
Yeah, I think there always has been. And I think what we see are there are moments where we reach kind of a little surge in attention to zoos and sort of the ethics of zoos and the health, the well-being of zoo animals. I think we're going through one right now with Blackfish, the documentary about SeaWorld. You know, let's just count animal parks more generally, aquariums and so on as zoos. Elephants in zoos, of course, have always been a kind of hot issue, a very controversial issue. The keeping of large animals in captivity that require large ranges, that have complex social behaviors and so forth. Primates, of course, is always a controversial issue. So there's certain taxa, certain species that have been at the center of ethical debates and public debates about the morality of zoos for a long time. And every now and then, these episodes sort of flare up. The recent episode of Marius the giraffe in Copenhagen is a pretty good example of some of the ethical debate about population management in zoos. So you have these very specific debates, and then you have the more general debate about the kind of ethical justification of zoos in society more generally. It's certainly not just a 21st century discussion. It's something that I think zoos have been grappling with, for better or for worse, for decades.
Efforts to win a last-minute reprieve for a young giraffe at Copenhagen Zoo have failed, and the zoo has put the animal down. The zoo rejected offers from two wildlife parks to take Marius, although thousands of people had signed a petition urging it to find another home for the animal.
Copenhagen Zoo's director, Bengt Holst, insisted he had to carry out the act of euthanasia because the gene pool for giraffes in Europe was too small and that despite being healthy, Marius was surplus to requirements.
Do you think that the public has a very clear idea of what the reality is for the people who run, manage and work in zoos?
I don't. I actually don't. And I think that's part of the problem. We want zoos to be Disneyland. We want zoos to be these sort of bucolic, peaceful, beautiful, deathless environments. I'm not sure the public really understands the backstage reality of managing animal populations in zoos. And I think there's a sense of wanting it both ways, of wanting zoos to be very natural, very real. But of course, the flip side of that is that if you're going to do those things, you know, death, disease, sickness is part of that equation. And so if you're going to really represent that in a zoo, you're going to have a very different kind of experience for zoo goers than what most of us are used to.
Dr. Brian Norton is a professor of philosophy at Georgia Institute of Technology and an editor of Ethics on the Ark, Zoos, Wildlife Conservation and Animal Welfare. We spoke by Skype.
Well, I think there are two or three different areas where zoos come into our way of thinking. The traditional one, or the one that's gotten most public attention, I guess, is people with animal rights views or even animal welfare views. And this is an important distinction. Animal rights seems to be a much stronger concept than animal welfare. But both of them can lead people to say that it's unfair to keep wild animals in cages. Animal prisons is sometimes the phrase used by advocates for ending zoos. So that there's that big controversy that just goes on and on and on. I mean, there's a whole literature, of course, on animal rights, and a fairly good portion of that has dealt with zoos. I think more importantly myself, for my own work, about 20 years ago, I guess, maybe a little more than that, people started thinking of zoos as educational sites. And this second movement is not unconnected to the other, because when people say, I hate to see animals in cages, one comeback was, okay, we'll give them naturalistic sites. For example, here in Atlanta, the Ford Foundation provided money to make a gorilla exhibit, and you really could think that you're in in the jungle. I mean, when you look into that, and the animals have much space, they're functioning communities and so on. So in some cases, at least, we can answer the animal prisons argument with better caging. But it's also true that these animals are still not free and wild, and so that debate goes on. Animal welfare people are much happier with naturalistic caging, but the animal rights people say it's wrong to have them in cages at all.
What often happens with the discussion of zoos, or the ethical discussion of zoos, is that it can polarize those who think the priority should be on animal rights or animal welfare, or whether we're talking about a question of conservation, species conservation, let's say in particular. And that community tends to be much more accepting of zoos and seeing their role in not only having these animals in exhibits as ambassadors for their species that are threatened in the wild, let's say, and the educational component of all that, and also just the sheer wonder of seeing those animals up close and personal, but the role that zoos can play in these programs, in captive breeding or conservation breeding, in reintroduction, in assisting in field techniques and research, and sharing knowledge and sharing resources with conservation organizations, and supporting community groups that are engaged in conservation, and all of that, right? So I think that, you know, the ethics of zoos, it tends to get narrowed, and it tends to focus on the animal rights discussion primarily, and it tends to be a very negative discussion. And I certainly respect people who feel that way, feel very strongly about zoos from that perspective. But I would argue that to really understand zoos today as an ethical question and their future, you have to think of this broader conservation and biodiversity dimension that zoos are wrapped up in and always have been. And I think that a truly responsible appraisal of zoos has to take into account their function, and increasingly an expanding function, as conservation organizations.
This is Rear Vision on RN with me, Keri Phillips. Today we're hearing about the evolution of the modern zoo.
Sydney's Taronga Zoo has welcomed a rather large new addition to the fold with its first female Asian elephant calf born overnight.
A Komodo dragon at London Zoo has stunned experts with a virgin birth. Genetic testing has proved that these baby lizards don't have a father. The experts are baffled at the process, but somehow the mother's egg fertilised itself.
The world's most endangered crocodile species is getting a survival boost from conservationists in Melbourne. A successful breeding program has seen the first Philippines crocodile born at Melbourne Zoo.
Most animals in zoos these days are born and bred in zoos, rather than captured in the wild. Despite that, for opponents of zoos, a role in conservation doesn't justify keeping animals in captivity. Claire Fryer is the campaign coordinator for PETA Australia.
Well, PETA doesn't believe that animals are ours to use for entertainment. All animals in zoos are denied everything that's natural and important to them. Every aspect of their lives is manipulated and controlled. They're told what they will eat, when they will eat, when they can sleep, who they can mate with. The key to saving exotic animals lies in saving their habitat and not in keeping them confined in unnatural and often neglectful environments. Zoos claim to provide educational opportunities, but most visitors are only going to spend a few minutes at each display. They're seeking entertainment rather than enlightenment. They teach people that it's acceptable to interfere with these animals, to keep them locked in captivity. Zoos often have babies there as crowd pleasers. The breeding programs are under the guise of species preservation, but inevitably they result in a surplus of the less cute adult animals, which are routinely traded, loaned, sold, or bartered when they're no longer wanted. And of course, most animals that are housed in zoos are not endangered. Those that are will very likely never be released into natural habitats. Returning captive-bred animals to the wild is in most cases impossible because these animals have been denied the opportunity to learn survival skills. They can transmit diseases to their wild counterparts. And of course, often they have no natural habitat left to return to because of human encroachment. So if zoos really cared about conservation, they'd put their resources behind habitat protection and anti-poaching efforts. What we need to do is stop breeding these animals and work on conserving the species in the wild.
It's not just animal rights groups that are critical of the modern zoo. Here's David Hancocks, the architect of the groundbreaking design at the Woodland Park Zoo, from a lecture he gave in 2012, highly critical of what he calls the AZA, the US Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
In 2112, people will be looking back on a century of biodiversity losses of heartbreaking proportions. And I wonder what they will think of our zoos, who spent so much energy preserving their status quo and doing so little to conserve wilderness habitats or even wild species. Compared to 100 years ago, zoos today offer excellent medical care and diets, but these simply reflect improvements in human society. The main difference from a century ago is a new look, a superficial improvement. And this new look is usually a peculiar distortion of the natural world. Since zoos have developed a design vernacular that I think is best described as Tarzan-esque, the AZA declares that the survival of the world's endangered species pivots on the conservation and education effort of modern zoos. The AZA asserts that simply visiting zoos benefits wildlife conservation. They say that seeing elephants up close in a zoo inspires visitors to become lifelong conservationists who will make personal lifestyle changes and donate funds to conservation programs. Each year, with 70 million zoo visits around the world, why don't we see evidence of these exuberant converts in general society?
In this brief overview of the modern zoo, it must be said that there's an enormous gap between the worst and the best, between aquariums that still, for example, display killer whales and dolphins, and zoos like the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum, which focuses exclusively on the interpretation of the natural history, plants and animals of its neighbourhood, the Sonoran Desert region. And that despite the occasional bad press, zoos remain a popular form of entertainment and recreation.
One of the interesting things is that the death knell of zoos has been rung for a very, very long time. And even in the 19th century, there were a lot of people who felt that there was something wrong with exhibiting animals in these kinds of settings. There's a famous American commentator, H.L. Mencken, who found these places to be places of banal knowledge defectively taken in. So it's a very long tradition of saying that these kinds of institutions are a lowbrow form of entertainment that really should go away. And the only thing I want to say about that is that it's a very long tradition of saying that, and yet they continue to do really well. And it seems to me that there's a certain kind of disconnect for people, that they seem to believe that these institutions will go away eventually, that somehow they're sort of a weird phenomena of the 19th and 20th century, but that they don't really belong in polite society. I see absolutely no evidence of this whatsoever. And on the contrary, I see people parking in the parking lot at the zoo relatively near where I live, and that parking lot does not seem to get any less full.
When you think about people and their fascination or interest in animals, obviously there are many ways of satisfying it. I mean, there are fantastic natural history museums, and the wildlife documentary has reached a very sophisticated level. Why is it that people still seem to feel the need to go to look at animals in zoos?
For as long as people have been around, they've been capturing animals and keeping them in captivity. And I think our pets are part of this tradition. And whenever there has been increasing leisure, the collections have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And this is not just in the modern world, but in the ancient world as well. So there seems to me, one could refer to it as biophilia if you want, the desire to sort of be close and intimate with animals and nature. Maybe it has something to do with that, but it seems to me that we're almost hardwired to desire to have this kind of close engagement with animals. And that kind of close engagement, you know, as you say, the wildlife documentaries do an amazing job of filling an hour with animals all over the place. And then people go to the actual quote-unquote wild, and they struggle because they don't actually see animals at every turn, because that's at some level what the wildlife documentary tells them is there. They go to the nature, they don't find it, but they go to the zoo and there's animals everywhere. And so there's, at some level, I think that that is filling that kind of need that people have.
Dr. Nigel Rothfels from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. His new book about elephants in captivity is called Elephant House. The other people you heard on Rear Vision were zoo architect and exhibit designer Michael Graetz, Dr. Brian Norton from the Georgia Institute of Technology, Dr. Michael Hutchins from the BirdSmart Wind Energy Campaign, Ben Mintier from Arizona State University, and Claire Fryer from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Russell Stapleton is the sound engineer for Rear Vision. I'm Keri Phillips. Bye for now.